take up Senate Bill 272. We've got a couple of individuals interested in the Dash 2 amendments, I believe. Would Frank Bronner and Karen Brazil please come forward?
Just remember, you're my leader and I'll follow you almost anywhere.
All right. Almost.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner, a member of the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. I appreciate your patience and understanding and bring to you the Dash 2 amendments today that, as far as I know, have been signed off by everybody. The Dash 2 amendments provide that with the unanimous consent of the three-member panel of the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board, questions will be framed and forwarded to the administrator of the Oregon Youth Authority for response. And should there be should it be possible to respond to those questions, obviously there'll be a response. Otherwise, there'll be an indication that there'd be a violation of state or federal law if there was a response, and both sides then can do whatever needs to be done. I appreciate very much the Justice Department for working with us, and Karen Brazeau for sitting down and working with us. I found it to be a pretty rewarding experience, Mr. Chair, and I commend them for their understanding.
Any question? I appreciate that you've worked together and reached a common ground, and Karen, you...
I'm Karen Brazeau, the director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I have submitted written testimony just for the record, and I don't need to review the amendments. Mr. Bronner has done a fine job in that, and after sitting down with him, I fully understand the issues that the board has faced in the past in working in the Youth Authority's facilities, and I think that the amendments could probably address many of the concerns that he experienced and other boards might experience, and believe that we could address those without even getting into the youth records that were at issue in the previous draft of the amendments.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you, sir.
We will soon have a committee, I hope, and we will pay further attention to your bill.
Appreciate your courtesy.
Thank you very much. Yep. I'm going to take a brief recess. I have before us Senate Bill 767. We have the Dash 1, Dash 2, and Dash 3 amendments. Is that right?
Yes.
We are concerning ourselves primarily with Dash 2 amendments, preference of the chair at this point. And Jan, would you give us a brief overview?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 767 originally had to do with changing how students were tested in Oregon. That language has been removed, and we have, as Senator Scar said, three sets of amendments before us. The Dash 2 amendments abolished the Certificate of Initial Mastery and Certificate of Advanced Mastery, and it also abolishes the current assessment system and directs the Department of Education to contract with independent educational assessment organizations to develop and implement the new statewide assessment system. And it would limit that assessment system to reading, writing, math, and science. And it also specifies that the assessment system must meet standards for educational and psychological testing. There's an emergency clause, and I think that's, there's a more detailed analysis of the amendments stapled to your staff measure summary, and I'd be happy to go through that, but probably don't want me to.
Thanks, Jan. The going to invite the proponents of the amendment first, and then we'll have a rebuttal from Steve Novak and Bill Autry. Rob Kramer, would you come up and talk to us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the chance to come and speak to you about this today. My name is Rob Kramer. I'm president of the Oregon Education Coalition. And this is an issue which I am sure all of you are quite well aware of. It's an issue that's been bandied about this building for many years. And the Dash 2 amendments are what I would like to speak about today. As Ms. McComb explained, Dash 2 amendments would require the state to contract with an outside testing organization to develop a new set of tests intended to measure student achievement of Oregon standards. And those tests would be in place. They would be fully compliant with No Child Left Behind. That is, they would have reading and math tests in grades 3 through 8. They would also have a science test three times in an age cohort between grades 3 and 10, as required by federal law right now. Be in place by year 2006-2007, also as required by federal law. Now the reason, and this bill or this amendment is essentially the same as House Bill 2415, which had considerable testimony on the House side. The reason we believe that these new tests should replace Oregon's current tests have to do primarily with the quality of tests that Oregon has developed over the last 10 years. We have tests in Oregon that do not allow comparison of Oregon student achievement with student achievement in other states. Oregon's tests, parts of them are highly subjective, and Oregon's tests take a long, long time to administer, not just the administration of the test, that is when the kids actually take the test in the classroom, but because of the format and the nature of the problem-solving assessments, the writing sample assessments, and then all of the portfolio assessments that go into the achievement of a SIM. Our schools are being consumed by day after day of practicing for these tests and administering these portfolio assessments. An incredible amount of class time is being taken up, time that could and should be used towards instruction, is being taken up and consumed by practicing for assessments, practicing for a certain format of assessments, whether it be a math problem-solving assessment or a writing sample assessment or giving speeches for the speech assessments, the speech portfolio items or SIM items, and the other of the 8 items that go into the achievement of a SIM. There's also some other problems with Oregon's system of assessments, and I have a package of materials for you there that explains some of it. There was an outside study done by an economist at Oregon State University. You may have seen the cover of Brainstorm magazine 2 months ago. A study that looked at Oregon's assessment scores over the last 5 years and found significant and credible evidence that the difficulty level of Oregon's tests had declined since 1998 in the third and fifth grade math tests, which explained a major portion of the supposed student gains on those tests during that time. Now, what this did was it called a question: how can we trust that the achievement data that we get from the state tests is real? We essentially have a conflict of interest. The same entity which is accountable for implementing Oregon School Reform Act also designs the tests that measure whether the School Reform Act is working. Now, I think if we learned anything from Enron and Arthur Anderson, we learned that essentially you don't want too cozy of a relationship between an auditor and a company. Well, we have that kind of conflict, I believe, with the same entity, the Oregon Department of Education, developing the test that measures the success of the reform they are accountable for implementing. And because of that, it only makes sense to have an outside organization create the test aligned to Oregon standards that measures whether or not Oregon students have met Oregon standards. Now, you might ask, well, we've gone down this road for 11, 12 years. We've got all these tests and spent lots and lots of money developing these tests. Aren't we throwing that all away now by having somebody else come in and design new tests? And, in fact, that would be the case if it wasn't cheaper to have a brand new set of tests developed from scratch than what the state would be spending simply administering our assessments in the next biennium. That is, to have an outside organization create a brand new set of Oregon's tests and administer them would cost less than what the Oregon Department of Education would spend next biennium simply on their assessment activities to add questions to our current tests and to administer our current tests. So all of the sunk costs that we've already spent developing test questions and test banks of questions essentially is just that, a sunk cost. If it's cheaper to move ahead with new tests, then it's cheaper to move ahead with new tests. There's been a lot of controversy over the years about Oregon's tests, and I think all of you are well aware of those controversies, and I'm not sure how much we have to go into those in this hearing, although I would be more than happy to. But, as you most of you know, I ran for superintendent of public instruction last year during my campaign. Everywhere I went on the campaign trail, I asked teachers that I met two questions. Do you support Oregon School Reform Act and these tests? Do you think these tests are a good measure of student achievement? And I got almost universal, I would say 90% to 95% no. Our teaching staff do not support these assessments, and that's why they're not working. Now, we were asked on the House side to prove that there was a lot of public support for getting rid of this system of assessments. I put together a website that had an online petition that asked people to leave their name and allow us to use their name, both posted on the website and use their name in the media, as supporting the effort to essentially repeal Sim and Cam and replace the test with an outside testing company. And in a matter of weeks, we had nearly 2,000 people leave their name on the website and allow us to use their name. Among those 2,000 people, and I have a list of all of the people in your package there. It's a printout of all the petition signers. I think 268 of them currently are teachers. There's a 20 or 21 school board members, current and former. There are 700 some odd parents, business owners, more than 100 business owners, 200 or 300 students, maybe more than 300 students, and hundreds of other citizens. There's a tremendous amount of support for getting rid of Oregon school reform assessments and replacing those assessments with assessments that do allow comparison to students in other states, that do have objective tests, not subjective tests, subjectively scored tests, and that are written towards test construction standards, national test construction standards. So I urge you to support this bill and to amend House Bill 767 with the -2 amendments. Thank you.
Question? Thanks, Rob. Dawn?
I'm Dawn Phillips from Representative Miller's staff, and if you have any questions about what we've been through in the process of investigating this and getting feedback from the public, I'm happy to answer any of those and kind of the experiences we've had through the hearings and the overwhelming support, as Rob mentioned, that we've heard from the education consumers, the parents, the teachers, the students themselves who have complained to us. We've received hundreds and hundreds, literally, of emails. I mean, I brought my stack today of just some of the research that we've done, but I left behind a notebook about that thick of all the emails we've received, and I think I brought it to your committee about a month ago, and it was about half that big of folks who think this is a flawed system, a waste of time, energy, and perhaps, given our budget situation, money to continue on this path. And as you all know, the House passed House Bill 2744 yesterday. And if you heard the comments that Representative Miller made on the floor, it might look like it's doing something with 2744. It's not. 2744 is simply a technical permission slip to allow the State Board of Education to do what they're already doing, which is basically keeping the status quo, keeping the SIMS in place for math, English, and science, and making the other four or five SIM-related topics optional. And it's still going to cost us money. It's still going to involve all the work samples, all the portfolios, all the extra work that the teachers have been complaining about and the students have been complaining about. It doesn't change anything in the status quo. You have an opportunity here to take a stand and to, as Representative Miller said yesterday, walk the walk and say it's time to get rid of this flawed system and do something about it instead of simply offering up lip service that we're making some kind of big change in the system this session. Unless we do something now, today, with this bill, I think Representative Miller would agree that we're not going to get any significant reforms this session. We need to make an effort. And I am asking you on behalf of Representative Miller and all the students and parents who've contacted us and the teachers to make a difference, to do something about this. So I'm available for questions if you have any.
At this moment, no questions. I'd like for you to hang around where we perhaps will have some questions. I'd like to call Diane Waldron to talk to us about SIM testing.
Senator Starr, members of the panel, my name is Diane Waldron. I'm a retired public school teacher after 33 years in Oregon schools. I'm currently assisting in Senator Gary George's office. I would urge support of House Bill 767. As I understand it, it would switch us back to a norm reference testing. I'd like to tell you what my experiences were with the tests that were leading up to the SIM and CAM before I retired in 98. According to the dictionary, a norm is a standard or a model or something that's typical. And I would like to say that the tests that have been developed by the State Department of Education are absolutely not standard, not model, and not typical. They're exceedingly flawed, and they're, according to everyone I have talked to, dumbed down over the old standardized tests we used to give. I remember when we had a gentleman from the State Department come in the early 90s and speak to us at Tillamook High School and tell us that it was really exciting preparing for the SIM and CAM because it was just like changing the wings of an airplane in mid-flight. And I suspected then and still do that we would have the same results of changing the airplane wings in mid-flight. First of all, the tests that they were giving us, building up to, have been changed every year. And I have that in a letter here from William, I don't know how you pronounce his name, A-U-T-Y, Auti, Associate Superintendent from the Department of Ed, that the tests are rewritten each year. And one of the questions asked was, what are the Oregon norms? And the answer given by William Auti is, Oregon norms are the results of all students tested the previous year. For Senate Bill 131, this would mean comparing the score obtained by a student on an Oregon test to the scores of all students who took the same test the last year. Well, that doesn't give you any grade level comparison. That does not give you any percentile. That simply gives you a comparison to a number from last year, a number that changed from the year before. The tests that I remember giving, I was sent down the hall to give a language arts test in about 95 or 96, and this one was newly written, and it included a half-page article regarding a gentleman named Representative Ron Wyden, and told how some constituents had come to Ron Wyden and told him of a problem, and Ron Wyden had miraculously solved this problem. Then there were true-false questions regarding what did they comprehend from this. And I thought, this is pretty slick, putting in the name of a living politician into a test for an 11th grader who is soon to be of legal age to vote. And this is going out all over the state. I'm more familiar with the old California achievement tests and the Stanford and the Michigan because I've given them throughout my years as a teacher. They have standards, they have norms, and you can take a child and plug him into the chart and come up with a grade level performance for the basic skills. You can also come up with a percentile performance. You cannot do this with the Oregon test, to the best of my knowledge. All you get is a number, like your child scored 218 on the Oregon test. And the parent says, what does that mean? And the teacher fumbles around and says, well, they did pretty well. We were hoping they'd do better, and we think they'll do better next year. And the parent is told nothing, and the teacher knows hardly anything except that the kid was somewhere in the middle of where the class scored. You're probably already aware that Oklahoma went into the Sim and Cam in the mid-early 90s, and when they ran an investigation of it after 3 or 4 years, they concluded it was terribly expensive, it was subquality education, and they threw it out, and they also fired their state superintendent of public education. The Sim and the Cam are highly ineffective, and they're very expensive, but you cannot get a statement from the Department of Ed about the cost. 2 years ago, when I asked them a question about the cost, they told me the first year it was roughly $1 million, the next year it was $1.5 million, possibly $1.5 million. They had absolutely no record of what they had paid for this test, although it was prepared by a private firm. At least that's what they said 2 years ago. Now they say that the Oregon teachers wrote all the items, and the ODE staff designs the test. Well, I'm not quite sure where the truth is, whether the private department designs the test or ODE does. But I do know those tests are sub-quality. They do not indicate much after the students take those tests, and I would urge support of House Bill 7. She must have the wrong number on it. But anyway, I would urge support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of Diane? Thanks, Diane. Steve and Bill, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Novick, the legislative coordinator for the Department of Education. Superintendent Castillo opposes the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 767 and would urge the committee to start taking a look at House Bill 2744, which passed yesterday with a resounding, I believe it was a 48-9 vote. We don't have any written testimony specifically for this hearing, but we've given some materials which we hope will be helpful. You have Superintendent Castillo's floor letter to the House that was sent out yesterday. You also have the testimony before the House Committee of Pat Burke, which describes the requirements of No Child Left Behind. One thing I'd point to in that packet is the letter we received from the federal government saying that Oregon's assessment system is approved for purposes of No Child Left Behind. And one objection the superintendent would have to being ordered to contract out for a new system is we'd have to go through that same approval process again for any new system with the federal government. We've also attached testimony that Mr. Audie presented to the House Committee on Education, and it includes a comparison of the costs of administering tests produced by private publishers with the costs of the assessments that we have now. And Mr. Audie since then has been in communication with private testing firms and getting further cost comparisons, and we've also distributed a sheet reflecting what he's learned in the context of those discussions. House Bill 2744 does make significant reforms to our assessment system and the SIM and the CAM. It would postpone mandatory implementation of CAM for all schools for 4 years. It would limit the subjects required for the SIM to English, math, and science, and thus, you know, repeal previous requirements that the SIM include assessments in social sciences and arts and second language. Arts, second language, and physical education. Another thing that the House Bill 2744 also addresses some issues related to portfolios and work samples. Now, the fact is that since 1995, portfolios have not been required as part of an assessment system, but there has been some confusion on that score. House Bill 2744 picks up on a suggestion by Representative Tootie Smith and eliminates the current language in statute that says that assessment may include portfolios, to make it clear that districts are not required to collect, you know, big collections of student work as part of our assessment system. The work samples, you know, the student writing and math problem solving exercises, which we believe are an important part of our assessment system. Mr. Roddy can speak to that a bit. We think that it's important the assessment system includes something other than multiple choice tests. There has been some concern that some of the districts have been requiring more work samples than the state actually requires. And one thing that the bill does is it says that if a district is going to require more work samples for the SIM than the state requires, then it's going to have to ask permission, essentially. So that addresses that issue. We believe that the assessment system that we have, you know, is, you know, a valid system, and Mr. Roddy can speak to some of the outside review that we've had of the assessment system in addition to the federal government approving it for No Child Left Behind. I'd like to address a couple of the points that Mr. Kramer made. For one thing, the idea that it's somehow a conflict of interest for the department to be developing the tests and then having the test items written by Oregon teachers. Enron and Arthur Andersen were separate companies. Enron hired an outside independent company, Arthur Andersen, and between them they cooked the books. If the department were ordered to contract with an outside company and the department's idea was to cook the books, I think that the department would probably have no problem telling the outside company to help cook the books. So I don't really understand that analogy. Unless the legislature wants to contract independently and cut out the Department of Education entirely, I think that if we wanted to cook the books, we would. Mr. Roddy will explain that we're not cooking the books. I would encourage you to review the record of, I mean, to take listen to the tapes of the hearings the House Committee heard on 2744. There was not an outpouring of, you know, uniform opposition to our current system. There were folks who didn't like the current system. There were a lot of folks who did. There were also, I think that almost 25% of the testimony was from PE teachers who were concerned about the elimination of PE as a mandatory part of the SIM. So it's quite an eclectic mix that we heard. In terms of assessments allowing for comparison between states, I mean, one point that we want to make sure that everybody is exposed to about No Child Left Behind is that the federal government did not create any national standard or national tests. And you'll see this in Pat Burke's testimony that's attached in your packet. The federal government told each state, develop your own standards, develop your own assessments, and that's what the states are doing. So it's not as if there's a national standard, national test out there that everybody's picking except Oregon. The states were told to, in effect, do your own thing. And I think that I don't dispute that out of the 30 or 40,000 teachers in the state, Mr. Kramer, who developed an elaborate network through his campaign, was able to get 268 teachers to sign a petition saying they oppose the SIM and the CAM. But I don't think that that necessarily indicates that all the teachers in the state want to get rid of our current assessment system. And in fact, the Oregon Education Association has spoken out against such a suggestion. Thank you very much. I'd like to turn over to Mr. Roddy to give more, far more detailed and technical responses to Mr. Kramer's points.
May I ask a question?
Yes. Thanks. Senator Morissette.
You mentioned the standards made in the adjusted in the House, getting rid of PE. What happened to health education? Is that was not part of the SIM and CAM to start with? I understand it was going to be made part, and then it was taken out. Is that correct?
For the record, my name is Bill Otte. I manage the assessment office for the Department of Education. My understanding is that does include health as one of the optional areas in which schools can. They're called SIM endorsements. In other words, they can be added on, and we do have a curriculum that, and standards will be adopted for that.
Sure.
Okay.
I I appreciate the testimony. We are talking about the Dash 2 amendments and not about House Bill 2744. That undoubtedly will be in this committee, and we'll have an opportunity to look at that later. So let's confine our comments to the Dash 2 amendments, please. Any other questions? Please.
Yes. To continue the particular to the issue of replacing the assessment system that we've developed in Oregon with a national publisher's test, I want to make 3 points: the time, quality, and cost. There was a comment about the time that it takes to administer the assessments. In the back of the larger packet that you have, about the third page from the end, there's a chart that lists the time required for students to take the assessments. Even going to next year when we're increasing the number of tests, the largest amount of time for a ninth or tenth grader to take the test is under 10 hours, and that's less than 1% of the instructional time that's available to students. Again, there should be time that is spent preparing for them, but it's really teaching. That we say that teachers and students should be spending a considerable amount of time preparing, learning the content that is tested by the tests. But the tests themselves are not time-consuming. I'm going to restrain myself from all the comments about the quality of the test. I could go into great detail, but I think it might be more useful to consider that the standards... There is no licensing agency for state assessment systems. However, there are professional standards. They've been developed by the American Psychological Association, American Educational Research Association, and the National Council of Measurement in Education. And those standards are referred to in this bill. We had Professor Tom Haldane from Arizona State review our system last year, and he said that we do currently meet those standards. So we already have an assessment system, and essentially meeting those standards would address all of the concerns that were raised earlier. So the quality of our state assessment system has been established. The last one is cost. We've just presented to the Education Subcommittee of the Ways and Means on the assessment budget. And the single page that you have here results from a request from the committee for us to go out and compare to what publishers would charge. And we contacted two nationally well-respected publishing companies and asked them, what would it take for you to come into Oregon and do the assessment system? And you can see their bids down there, and they are essentially more expensive than we have. Part of what is perhaps not understood is that most of what we do is already contracted out. We contract out with educational data systems to do most of the handling of the multiple choice test. They do the scoring. This year we started having the Oregon Corrections Enterprises, the prison system, do the printing and shipping, and we get a tremendous deal from them. The other work we contract out with Oregon teachers. We feel that writing items and scoring the writing and math problem solving are activities that should be done by Oregon teachers. They get, in both cases, either the scoring or the writing, they get trained and their work is reviewed. So there are objective standards of quality to ensure that they are competent to do that. So you see, and then we have online testing, which is TESA project, which is students are able to take the test at the computer. This is very exciting. It provides for instant feedback to students, and it's considered to be of high value. That is not included in what the publishers are proposing. So essentially, going out to a national publisher would decrease services and responsiveness to students and teachers and cost more. So it's not something that we recommend for that purpose. I should also comment that this bill also specifically requires testing every grade. And the bids that you see here and what we've been doing are only in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school. The testing, particularly for first and second graders, can be very expensive because you cannot just put a bubble sheet in front of them. So I don't have a specific bid on all of those costs, but it would be higher than what is listed here. And that's very brief in my remarks, and I'm welcome to answer the questions.
When was the SIM first awarded to graduating seniors or to Oregon High School students?
Chair Starr, the first class that graduated are now sophomores in high school, so it would have been 2 years ago was the first time seniors came out. It counted as 10th graders for them, so that would be 2 years before that.
And those graduating as seniors last year, what percentage of them qualified for the SIM?
Chair Starr, I'm not sure the exact number. It's in the 25 to 35% range.
Ten years and we've got 25 to 35%. Interesting. Any other questions?
Well, thank you. That's not a graduation requirement.
Chair Starr, Senator Morissette, that is correct. This is, and it also is a local decision in the districts decide what the standards are beyond the state minimum.
And as far as, well, may I?
Yes.
As far as being accepted in college, the grade point is, but also the other national tests that are taken are determining factors, right? Now, do any high schools require the SIM for graduation?
Chair Starr, Senator Morissette, I believe...
Besides IOM.
I believe North Clackamas does, and there may be others. It is a small number.
Okay, so North Clackamas requires the SIM for graduation.
That's correct.
Do they have a problem in graduating students because they can't pass the SIM?
Chair Starr, Senator Morissette, I can't speak directly. I know that the superintendent did testify in the consideration of House. I'm not supposed to mention the other House bill, but he did testify in favor of the SIM. So I would not. I would interpret therefore that he does not have a serious problem with what we're proposing.
This is not a question, but I just have to comment that I, too, taught before the era of the SIM and the CAM, and I've worked under a different system, and I think part of the problem, there is some, disarray in some respects in terms of what is required and what is not required, and unless that is settled, I think there will be some major changes that will be made. I'm not personally, I think there are some problems, and I think that people have to decide how important it is and whether or not it's important. The students speak with fire on that. It is, fortunately or unfortunately, voluntary. Our districts have the option. So.
Chair Senator Moore said I would concur, and I've said that is an area the department takes seriously. We expect that the one result of all the attention that this group has paid to the SIM and the CAM during the session will result in a clearer picture, clearer legislation, and we will carry that message out.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, we're just having a procedural discussion over here.
All righty.
Senate rules prevent us from taking testimony on a bill not posted. I think that it isn't that you can't refer to the bill, but going through the major principles of it essentially puts us in a position of hearing testimony on a bill not posted, and that simply is not acceptable, because then folks who would come later to say that they wanted to make testimony on the bill would be angry at the chair and call us out for being in violation of Senate rules. So it's not about not mentioning the bill or what the bill does or even a status report on the bill. It's just too much testimony on a bill not in in the committee's possession or on which we do not have an open hearing puts us near violation of our own Senate rules.
Excuse me. Thank you. That testimony was given in the opening remarks, and that there was a response to that. And so I guess that should have been made clear before we started the public hearing.
Yeah, I don't, Mr. Chairman, see it as a violation. The point is it's interesting that we at least know our rules and give them a nod.
Who's the scholar that figured that out?
Mr. Chairman, to our good senator from Springfield. I was called out on it and thoroughly trounced and embarrassed one day for allowing somebody to go on and on about a bill not in the committee's possession. So once you get nailed like that, you don't remember.
I appreciate that.
I'm the one who asked the question. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's all right.
You need to stick to the subject.
I know you're interested in health education. I appreciate that. There's been public comment and even a publication that indicates that the SIM or the tests that you've developed are offered in gradations, that you give a different level of the students who are superior in their performance get a tougher test than students who are not as far advanced as students might otherwise be for the same grade level. Is that in fact happening?
Chair Starr, I'm not certain which particular reference you're talking to. We do provide what are called levels tests, so that at any grade level, there are three different tests. They are all equal in their scoring, in that if the student of the same ability were to take two versions of the test, either one, they would get the same score. Essentially, it refers to the range of the test. And if what we want for students who are of higher ability, we want to be able to give them items that challenge all of their ability. So is that if we gave a single test that had to meet the whole range of abilities for all the students in the state, the very able students wouldn't have enough questions to show what they know, and they'd sort of they top out on the test. So we give them some more difficult items so we can generate a good score up higher. Similarly, students who are less able are given some more items that are at lower levels, which allows them to accurately measure where they are. Any of those tests measure to have enough items so that we can measure the standard, the SIM standard or the eighth grade standard, whatever it is. And if a student were to take one version or the other, they would still score the same score. This is a well-established testing procedure. We have statistical evidence that verifies our equating of the tests, and we've had external, we have a national review committee that has looked at those results. And so there are three levels. They do not disadvantage or advantage any student in terms of meeting the standard. It's just for getting a more accurate measurement at their level, particularly students who are very able or less able.
Interesting. That's a different way of testing than I'm used to. Any further questions?
Well,
yes, Senator Marsden.
Then you must then predetermine who will take which test by other standards.
Chair Starr, Senator Moore said that is correct. We provide, there are several methods. You can give a short test that sort of gives a rough indication of where the student's ability is. We can allow it, if a student has tested previous years, you may know where their performance is. And many of the teachers, and probably most of the teachers, understand well the performance of their students because they do lots of assessment during the year, and they have a rough idea of where that is. So we provide those methods, and we've provided training to teachers on how to make those decisions.
Okay. One other question.
Yes.
Does the student have a chance to challenge a test if they feel like they're being labeled? I guess that would be a teacher determination, but it just seems to me that could cause some difficulty if there was not a way of challenging where you were placed. If you were placed in the middle or the bottom and you felt you should be able to take the higher test, I would hope that they would be able to or at least challenge the test or challenge it.
Chair Starr, Senator Morissette, we provide a number of opportunities for schools would have to make that determination.
Well, I guess the parents would probably have some input in that if they felt that their child was not given the test that they felt they were capable of taking. I would imagine that would be the case.
Mm-hmm. And Chair Starr, Senator Morissette, we also provide information back to schools if we detect that schools have been giving the wrong level to many students. We give that feedback to them. We said, if you had given more of your students the more difficult, they would have been able to score higher.
I guess you have to back up a bit, and it seems to me, and as Senator Starr said, that's a different way of testing. I mean, ordinarily you would give everybody the same test and determine where people are. And what you're doing is you're categorizing them into three different groups and you're giving three different tests, which I was not aware of. And I don't know if that's good or bad. I mean, from my experience, I have no way of knowing. So that's something I guess I will take a look at.
Chair Starr, Senator Morissette, I'd be glad to make available to the committee. We have a videotape and other information that we published. Maybe 6 years ago when we first did this, and I'll make that available to the committee.
I don't want to be overwhelmed with a lot of material I'm not going to have time to look at, but if you could give me some basic information in a relatively brief form that I can look at, and I'll decide if I want to go further, and I may go back to my various districts, my Senate school districts, and ask some questions.
We can do that.
That would give me a starting point. I appreciate that.
The question that bothers me regarding that three levels of test is you alleged that if a student took two of these tests, the final results would indicate the exact same placement as far as their ability is concerned. Seems to me that would be a little difficult. It's been alleged that, in fact, the opposite occurs, that students of lower ability taking a test that's less difficult could, in fact, score higher than a student who is taking a more difficult test. Challenge their ability, and that in doing it in that manner, then one perhaps would fail, not qualify for passage of the SIM requirement, or a student of a lower ability taking a weaker test could qualify. But your perception or your design of this is that regardless, the three levels of testing will deliver a result that's uniform, accurately placing the student according to their ability.
Chair Starr, that is correct. Stop me if this is more detailed than you want. Any test is most accurate in the middle, and when you get down to 0 or 1 or 2% correct, or 97, 98, 99%, then the effect of one item, which by chance you might get right or wrong, becomes a factor. And so tests at their ends are more error prone. The problem with a general test is that you have more kids out at the end. Our idea is to get three levels of tests that are mostly overlapping, and at the area of the standard for the grade level, they are all accurate. The statistical term is within two standards errors of measure, but that's so we are accurate at the point of the standard. Where we are trying to be increasingly accurate is well above the standard or well below the standard, so that we can provide teachers and students with, who are away from the standard with the most accurate information about their level of achievement.
Yes, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may interject, as someone, as a layperson in these matters with a lot less experience in education issues than either the chair or any members of the committee, the way I understood this, Mr. Roddy explained it to me, and I hope that, that I remember correctly that he agreed with this, is if you have everybody take exactly the same test, then there'd be a bunch of kids at the top who get everything right, and you won't be able to differentiate between them, and there'll be a bunch of kids at the bottom who get everything wrong, and you won't be able to differentiate between them. But if you have the different levels, then you'll be able to sort out differentiation at the top and at the bottom.
Well, I don't understand that, because that, are you saying that all of the tests that we used to give before the invention of the Simon Cam were not valid? Because I had, you know, there are all kinds of ways you can do that on a bell-shaped curve if you want to, and you try to design a test that is somewhere aimed in the middle that will show who, you know, can excel and who needs more work. And so I just don't understand. I need more information about this system, because you know, there's all kinds of ways the bell-shaped curve can do that, I guess. You just, well, anyway. But people, see, this is where I think grade inflation sometimes comes in, because you can play with that. You know, you can and I do believe grade inflation occurs, that, you know, teachers often say, gee, you know, I've experienced teachers who give nothing but A's and B's. That's not fair. Well, unless you have an AP class, you know. If you have an AP class, then you have a different grading system. But when you have a class of average students, you expect that they're going to be on both sides. And I worked very hard to develop a test that was, that I thought had material that I covered that people should know. If they know it, they're going to score way up there. If they didn't pay attention and don't know it, they're going to be there. And the ones in the middle get a C or something like that. So I just, that's a whole new way of doing it. But I mean,
we'll provide more information.
Other. I appreciate the testimony. Any further questions? Well, thank you very much. You've been most informative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would like Rob and Diane to come back up and respond to some of the information. I don't know whether I should be disturbed about these three-level tests for a SIM. I'm sure a lot of effort has gone into that, and a lot of hard work. Would either of you care to speak?
Mr. Chair, sure. I would certainly like to respond to a couple of things that were presented. Rob Kramer, President of the Oregon Education Coalition, for the record. About the levels tests, as I traveled the state during my campaign, there was a lot of discussion of those tests, because it does raise a lot of eyebrows. What do you mean we're giving three levels of tests for each, you know, third grade math test, fifth grade math test? And it doesn't seem to make sense that we'd have three difficulty levels of tests. And it goes back to the claim from the Oregon Department of Education, essentially, trust us. Trust us that these tests, a student would score the same on any one of the three levels, and we're just trying to better differentiate the difficulty or the achievement levels of a student. How do we really know? We don't.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ferrioli.
I'm going to just share a perspective, and I'd like to hear a reaction. I'm not sure if it's an official position of the agency. But I understood that there were three different levels of assessment and three different times that the tests were given. to provide the longest period of remediation if kids fall off the trajectory. In other words, you test them early and you test them often. And you test them against the school norms, at least. And the reason that you do that is it becomes a diagnostic tool. And if you do those tests at the midpoint in education and then late at graduation, it gives you less time to sort of redirect the educational components of that individual student's career in order to gain the best remediation, the best effect by the time they graduate. And so that's why you've got an early test, a midpoint test, and an ending test. I'm paraphrasing something that was explained to me about why there were three levels of tests and three difficulties of tests.
Well, we just heard different explanations. Yes,
I think, were you out of the room?
No, I heard it.
Okay. Now, what Mr. Kramer was just telling us was that there's three levels of tests given at each grade level.
That detail I did.
And that is, in fact, what we just heard testimony.
Thank you.
On. And
not one of us was out of the room. I was.
Well, maybe I was out of the room, and that detail got. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the teachers decide which test the student takes. So the third grade math teacher will say, Johnny will get test 1 or test A, and Jimmy will get test B, and Sue will get test C, based on their own subjective assessments of where that child is in the academic spectrum. Now, I see a lot of problems with this. Number one, I've talked to lots of teachers who said, well, I just gave every student test 2 because I didn't want to hassle with it. Other teachers have told me, well, I'm just going to give them all the easiest tests because I think they'll have a better chance of looking good because I believe that easiest test will have more children meeting the standard, and I'm being held to a lot of pressure to get more kids to meet the standard. Now, the Department of Education tells us that one child takes all three tests is going to have the same chance of meeting standard regardless of which test he or she takes. And again, that's where it comes down to trust us. Now, 5 or 6 years ago is when the levels tests were introduced. I have a hard time believing that when you introduce a level testing regime, now you have not affected the percentage of children who meet standard compared to prior to levels testing. So when we're saying our academic achievement from 1991, 1992, 1993, 1994, we've now grown, or it's raised achievement levels in 97, 98, 99, and 2000. Well, we've had levels testing in those latter years. And how can we then compare the percent of kids meeting standard to those prior years? We have a rubber ruler by which we're measuring our student achievement. That also brings up a similar question with the technology-enhanced student assessment. You may not also be aware, but now that some students are taking the test by computer, we have a different environment in which they're taking the same test. Now, we have not standardized conditions amongst how the kids are taking the test. One principle of a standardized test is you have to have standardized conditions. Some kids in front of a computer, some kids with paper and pencil, that's not standardized conditions. Number two, what's happening in the classroom? Student flunks or does not meet standard on TESA, on a computer-delivered test. Teacher gives them the same test 2 weeks later. I'm hearing that they're taking it 3, sometimes 4 times to see if they're meeting standard. Well, again, we've biased our results. By allowing students multiple chances to take a test to meet standard, how can we compare the percentage from meet standard to prior years before we have the computers? We can't. So there's tremendous problems in alleging that Oregon student achievement has grown over the 10 years of having our school reform efforts in place when they continue to change the tests and the administration of the tests and even the difficulty level of the questions on the test. One other item about the tests themselves. If you go to the Oregon Department of Education website and download the third grade sample math test, it's on their website, and you can take a look. There's 30 questions or 20 questions on the third grade sample math test. Not one question on that test requires the use of multiplication. Now, we supposedly have world-class standards in Oregon. I think every parent in Oregon would consider multiplication to be a standard they want their third grader to meet, yet the Oregon sample test doesn't require multiplication on that test. However, if that test had multiplication on it, it wouldn't really mean the student had mastered multiplication because the test booklet says students are allowed to take calculators in to the test. We let third graders take a calculator into a third grade math test. That's our world-class standard of tests that we've developed. I don't believe that is a world-class standard. Now, a couple other things that were brought up in testimony, questions about any school districts require the SIM for graduation, and the question being North Clackamas High School. They tried to require the SIM for graduation, and so did Reynolds School District. And when it became apparent that they would be denying diplomas to upwards of 75% of their students, they then backed off that and said, yes, we require a SIM, but if you don't meet the requirements for a state SIM, you can still meet the requirements for a local North Clackamas or Reynolds School District SIM. And that's what they have fallen back on. So they aren't requiring a state SIM for graduation. They've seen that that was going to be futile, and now they require only a North Clackamas SIM. And oddly enough, to get the North Clackamas SIM, you have to meet the diploma requirements in North Clackamas.
Interesting.
Well, may I?
Yes, Senator Marcet.
Maybe that's a step up because in my experience teaching in high school for 28 years, I know there were kids who graduated that couldn't meet hardly any requirements. And that's, you know, social promotion was part of it and probably still is. And then I guess you have to determine whether or not it's a special needs student, but that's a different category. But, I guess I would say, though, or maybe I'm turning to a question, would at least meeting a local SIM be better than not having to meet anything?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, that's a very good question. That would obviously vary depending on what the local SIM requirements were. And I would hope, I would fervently hope that that would be a higher standard or mean something different than just the diploma. But one thing I think we can look at statewide, we've had this system in place now, you know, in phases for 11 years, 12 years. And we can ask that question now, I think. Has this improved education in Oregon? Because this is what we're all driving at. We're all trying to make this system better. And I believe even people who are big proponents of SIM and CAM are trying to make the system better. Let's ask the question, has it done so? Well, I think when you look at some outside evidence, for instance, SAT scores. Since 1995, Oregon's SAT scores, although they've increased, they haven't increased as much as the national average has increased. We've lagged the increases of the national average in our SAT scores, both on verbal and on math. So I can think, from that, we can say there's some partial evidence that maybe SIM and CAM has not increased achievement in Oregon schools.
Sand, do you have any comments you'd like to make?
Yes, sir. Senator Starr and members of the committee. Unfortunately, we've had deception going on in the area of test scores for even further back than the Oregon test. I first became aware of it in 1986 when I was moved from a severely disabled classroom to a learning center. In Tillamook County, in every one of the school districts, the regular practice at that time, and it continued through the 90s, was that when the standardized tests were given, the students in the learning center, which represent 15 to 20% of the student body, were not given the tests at the same time. Their tests were not sent in for electrical scoring, and therefore they were not averaged in with the rest of the students. Furthermore, they were not always given their grade level tests, but they were given lower grade level tests because, you see, the students in learning centers, for the most part, are students we have failed to teach to read. So we would give them a test that was two or three grade levels below level. And when their tests came back, they got fairly decent scores on that. The school district itself got an average overall score that was slightly above average, and we broke our elbows patting ourselves on the back telling the school board that we were doing a fine job, when really, if those 15 to 20% were figured in, we'd have been doing less than average. I don't understand the comments right now from the State Department that it would cost a lot more money to go outside the state and get a test written up. I don't see any need for that. There are standardized tests that are already in place. And furthermore, if we really want a good test, we can have them for absolutely free by going back before the copyright date, where it's past the copyright date, picking up these tests from the 70s, which the experts all agree are tougher tests than the standardized tests that were given in the 80s and early 90s. And these tests also have norms. If you wanted to give them in the fall, there are norms for the fall, and there are standardized nationwide norms, and also for in the springtime. And my homeschool students that I tested were doing excellent on these much tougher, older tests than they were than students would be expected to do today. So I would recommend that we put something in the bill that says to use a standardized test that's already written. Don't go out and contract for a special one. That's absurd.
Well, thank you. Any further questions? Comment. I got an email the other day that contained the 8th grade test from 1895. 90% of high school graduates today would not pass that test. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've heard compelling testimony on both sides of this issue. Folks, if we were able to move this bill, this -2 amendment today, it would go to Ways and Means. Chair would like to do that. I don't know that I've got the votes to do that.
Mr. Chairman, we heard about another bill, and that possibly will be coming to this committee. Interesting to me here, these bills side by side.
Let us wait, therefore, for a work session on this, and we will see if we get that other bill in short order.
And we won't mention what bill that is.
We won't mention that bill now.
You can mention it. You simply testify to it.
Oh, I see.
All righty. Well, I thank you for your kind attention, rapt attention. Those of you who've been here that long know that I've been discussing this issue now for 12 years. So I will not likely... Oh, that's right. Thank you, Jan.
We're going to do the other bill.
We're going to do the other bill.
Okay.
We had a hearing on a bill that has no opposition. It's a good bill. And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 767, and I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 272 and the -2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 272.
Senator Deckert has moved the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 272. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 272 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Deckert has moved Senate Bill 272 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator
Bailey? Aye.
Aye. Vice Chair
Dixon?
Aye.
Chair Smart?
Aye. I received the necessary majority. Senate Bill 272 has passed the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. I have a volunteer carrier.
Well, I think Senator Deckard
might be happy to.
Senator Deckard, thank you. Yes, thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you all. We are adjourned.